Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 6th, 2000. In the fireside room this morning is Phil Anderson. Today's session number is 2003, and it's titled On Borders and Beliefs, U.S. Policy and Practice, Vis-a-vis a Faith-Based Vision for Response to the Uprooted Migrants and Refugees. Bring me your tired, your poor, your hungry, yearning to be free, not. Let's listen in.
Stand, smaller group here because it is such a lovely day. I just went outside for a few minutes, walked down the trail here, and it's just one of those days where you want to sing the Psalms, you know. Oh God, my God, how majestic are you and the earth. So let me begin with, today we're going to focus on immigration. Who is allowed currently through legal means to enter the United States and under what conditions? And we might ask how they're being received in our communities. During the course of this week, I focused a little bit on refugees. One session, and that's a category of some people who may become eligible to emigrate to the United States. It's a category then of immigration, but it's a smaller number than the total of the pie, and that number has been going down of refugees admitted to the United States. From around the world, these are people that have fled Rwanda, fled Somalia, fled Afghanistan, fled Sudan, fled Bosnia, and they are at risk of persecution should they go back. So from about 130,000 that were admitted in 1992 when President Clinton came into office, we're now down to about 78,000 admitted per year. A 40% decline. And I work for Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, and one of the things that we're trying desperately to do is to get those numbers, LIRS.org, if you want to look up some stuff on all of this. Then yesterday we looked at the whole question of undocumented. And that is people who enter without inspection or who maybe entered in some way with inspection but overstayed their visa, as it were, and are out of status as far as their visa. And so they may not have work authorization in the United States. All of those are, you know, steps along the way. And so they technically are out of status and cannot work. We know many are working. Today we want to look at just immigration. I want to begin with a couple of preliminaries here. One biblical word from the book of Hebrews. Hebrews 13. Let mutual love continue. And I find this is interesting because it put love, verse 1, verse 2, do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers. Love strangers. You know, not love family, you know, strangers. For by doing that, some have entertained angels without knowing it. Some have entertained angels without knowing it, these strangers. It's like the Emmaus Road. You know, who is this stranger alongside? And it's only really by entering into conversation, dialogue, getting up next to, kind of incarnational, you know, bone, flesh, that we're going to know something about this person. And, you know, we have a marvelous world, and all of this is God's creation. And to just kind of limit ourselves to, me and my world and my community and my ethnic background and kind of my family. I mean, it just, in a sense, being out here in the majesty of this place, it just says, you're missing something, you know. There's a lot of messages. There's a lot of something that God is saying through God's creation that you're missing, you know. So it's a really an invitation, and I'd say that this whole biblical narrative and our tradition is so rich. When I started with Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service about 3 years ago, I'm not an immigration expert, I'm not a lawyer, I'm a pastor. I've done some work here and there in different parts of the world and in a lot of different kinds of communities, also in the U.S. with Native Americans, African Americans, Latin Americans, Southeast Asians, some other African immigrants. One of the terms that's quite interesting that is out there and is debatable is this word alien. And for a lot of people, that has a very negative connotation. And particularly people within my field, particularly when you might add another qualifier there, illegal alien or undocumented alien, that kind of thing. Well, but what I really refer to people, I think this is where the culture of the United States and particularly TV has weighed in a significant way. And it's where we have some work to do to recover a word that is an excellent word. This alien is not, you know, thinking about some extraterrestrial alien. It is, in fact, kind of all of our experience. What does this word mean? I've tried to do some parsing of it a little bit in the past, and I'd like to look at that more, but it really means out of one's land, or home. To be away from, where you consider to be home. Now that's, and it's used, yesterday you used it in the Joseph narrative, that was one of the first verses that we looked at in the Bible study. Alien, it's a rich word, being out, and it is a word that from the beginning of our experience, existential experience, we are alienated from God. We are alienated sometimes from ourselves. We are alienated from our neighbors. We are alienated. One of the interesting things also about all of this dynamic on, say, refugees and uprooted people and migrants and all of that is that this is profound. To be out of your land, out of your home, to be alien is a profound reality. I've had some depression, and it's like I have lost, you know, what it means, that anchor. And that's from a very physical, emotional experience. Can you imagine what it is to either be uprooted because of war, hostilities, persecution, or uprooted because of economic stuff, and to or because of other circumstances, you want to move from your land. I was out here just now in the last half hour out in the mountains, and I look at the beauty of these mountains. It is incredible that every refugee immigrant that I talk to, recent immigrant, their desire, no matter what the conditions of their physical surroundings are now, it would be to go home. And that's particularly true for the elderly. Where do I want to go and die? Last year, you remember, the United States set a goal during the Kosovo crisis to bring in 20,000 Kosovars. Finally, by the time the most immediate crisis was over, we had brought in about 13,000. They were brought in under some exceptional circumstances and conditions. That is, they were considered refugees, but in the first time in history, so they were admitted to the United States. They could come to the U.S., 13,000, and they had up to May 1st this year to decide if they wanted to stay in the United States. That's from like March, June last year. The United States would pay for them to go back to Kosovo if they wanted. The United States would pick up that bill. Never been done before. Well, here they've come, right, to the land of milk and honey from Kosovo, one of the poorest, it is the poorest province of Serbia and the former Yugoslavia. And with all of that ethnic hatred and the slaughter that had just gone on, the United States up to now has returned about 5,000. Yeah. And who were the first ones? Some of the professionals went back. Not just the elderly, but the people that said, that's my land, I'm going back and I'm going to rebuild. It's quite incredible. Some of that's a discursus, but I think it's really important when we look at this world in which there are today 6 billion people in the world, 100 million people on the move, migrating from country to country. One out of 60, approximately. People that are going to be alien. And the word is provide hospitality to the stranger. In so doing, you may attend angels unaware. Today, I hope to, an hour goes by tremendously fast, and there's so much. And I've worked in Africa, I've worked in Latin America, I've worked in conflict resolutions in Guatemala, Salvador, Nicaragua. This work that I'm currently doing with Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, I would say, has been the most stretching and stimulating and intellectually and sort of breaking through all sorts of stereotypes when I look at the complexity of immigration stuff. And particularly then as it relates to the U.S. southern border, all sorts of issues that I have to look at. History, we are a nation of immigrants. What does that mean? You know, so what? You know, you might say, well, we have been, we are today. Does that necessarily mean we will be tomorrow? Or under what terms? You know, we are John F. Kennedy, 1960, a nation of immigrants. What does that mean? So I'm finding this, and for the church, issues of the church. How do we provide hospitality to the stranger in our midst? And who are those people? And under what terms? I want to, maybe from the outset, there are groups out there. There's one group called FAIR. Very interesting name, FAIR, immigration. I think it's Federation of Americans for Immigration Reform. And they have chapters around. There's a California Immigrant Reform Coalition. Their point is picked up quite a lot by this little piece, Immigrants Out. And they would be the kind of people that say in California, whatever year, 1994, Prop 187, huh? That would have limited benefits to immigrants. That is, some were saying, you know, we won't even educate children who are not U.S. citizens. We will not allow medical services to be provided to non-U.S. citizens and immigrants out. So there's that, and that's a very, you could say, racist, was very anti-immigrant stance. There's another current out there that I would say is represented by a very laudable group. Anyone know what the issue is there with the Sierra Club?
Wasn't it environmental protection?
Okay, environmental protection, sure, that's their big thing. And thank God that, you know, we have the beauty of a lot of, like, this wilderness due to much of their consciousness raising. And okay, and what's the deal there?
Overpopulation.
You know, we're getting too many people, and it's going to somehow damage this. This environment that we live in, and also
didn't that die though, that idea?
Right.
Yeah, I think it was
recently it died. However, also very recently, in the last few months, one of the founders of this very notable person, for anyone's in the Sierra Club, I just caught it on some, I don't know, late night stuff, that he has defected from Sierra Club because Sierra Club has not continued to drive this zero population piece, and the non-immigrant piece particularly. And so this is quality of life stuff. Quality of life, you know, we like it like this, you know, and we're gonna keep it like this for us. You know, and there again, as we read the biblical narrative, I don't recall that kind of an attitude being talked about. Well, you know, just welcome the stranger as long as the stranger is not going to damage our quality of life or something, you know, or you know, it's really something. Yeah.
I'm sorry, were you saying that the FAIR group is pro?
No, anti-immigrant.
Well,
yeah, it's anti-immigrant, so it was those that were, you know, fostering a Prop 187 in California, and they're all over, you know, so they're a very vocal voice in Washington, D.C. Nation of Immigrants. Over the last couple of years, Mavis and I have gotten to New York City on a few occasions, and if you get out there, boy, just make sure you get out to Ellis Island. It is fabulous. They restored the Ellis Island. Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, of course, we feel tied to that image. In fact, it is kind of the symbol of the hand with the torch is the symbol of LIRS. You know, some people in the 80s were saying, well, we should... This faces east, of course, toward Europe. They were saying, well, it really belongs in San Diego or San Francisco or L.A., facing, in the 70s, facing Southeast Asia. You know, that's where the immigrants were coming from Cambodia and Vietnam, Laos. Others say it should be facing south. In fact, I've got a poster with the Statue of Liberty in a sarape, in a Mexican colored sarape, you know, facing south. It's lovely. On that is a very famous poem by Emma Lazarus, which I'd like to read and then ask kind of the question, you know, rhetorical, is this representative really of our attitude toward immigrants today? It's not a long poem. Not like the brazen giant of Greek fame, with conquering limbs astride from land to land, here at our sea-washed sunset gate shall stand a mighty woman with a torch, whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, and her name, Mother of Exiles. From her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome. Her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor that twin cities frame. Keep, ancient lands, your storied pomp, cries she with silent lips. Give me your tired you're poor. You're huddled masses yearning to breathe free. The wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Keep your storied pomp. Send me your huddled masses. Any reflection there?
When was that?
Very good question.
When did they build it?
1903. And this was. Yeah, and it. Yeah.
18 something.
Right. A gift from France, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was it 1880?
1884. As a symbol of friendship and of the liberty that citizens enjoy under a free form of government. And then this was inscribed in 1903, Emma Lazarus. It's interesting that now there is what's called the Emma Lazarus Fund, which is a huge philanthropic fund that does work with on behalf of immigrants. We tap into that as LIRS from time to time when we're doing specific issues related to the undocumented and the like. It's run by a man named George Soros. It's under the Soros Foundation. George Soros is this huge philanthropist, and he's made billions kind of on the stock market on what they call these hedge funds, which is you hedge your bet on where really the relative value of money is going to go, I think. So who knows? We're reaping the benefits of some high-tech capitalism to support some work with very, very poor people.
But that has been true for the Carnegies.
Sure, the Rockefellers, the Carnegies. Right. Yeah, yes, good. That's right, right. Yeah, okay.
My grandmother was 17 years old when she got on a boat in Norway with another 17-year-old girl, and no education, no money, no nothing, and came and was welcomed.
Uh-huh.
Now, if she came from Mexico today, no education, no money.
Okay.
No nothing.
Okay, she would not be admitted. That's correct. Let me go through a couple of quick things, and then we'll dialogue. Because I want to ask, who is coming and under what terms? That's kind of a who's coming and what terms kind of an issue. There are essentially now, and by the way, again, the history of immigration in the United States is fascinating. Right, maybe some of you have studied. It's worth even picking up a small little piece like this because, you know, there's the German flow, the Norwegian, the Irish, you know, and the Italians, the Poles, the Czechs, the Southeast Asians, the Mexicans. And by the way, Mexico, you know, did they migrate here? I mean, we just slopped off the northern part of Mexico, and there were 50,000 people who had been citizens of Mexico that all of a sudden, the next day, they were in the United States, you know? And it's interesting, and they're, you know.
More than that, you count Texas, too.
And Texas was previous to the 1848, right, exactly. So how does somebody come to the United States now if someone wants to emigrate to the United States legally? And how many are there? Any rough estimates on legal immigration to the United States per year? Yes?
I think you have to have a high-tech degree, and you have to have money to pay lawyers to be able to go through the legal system, and I don't know how many people they admit, 10,000 a year. You have to have some money to...
Good. Okay. Interesting. Okay. That's very good. And degree?
I know nobody like that.
Uh-huh. All right. Very good.
What's the green card they have to have?
Green card is work authorization.
That's
it.
They probably
have. Right. green card. It's not green, but, you know, it's called a green card. Okay, that's work authorization. Boy, if you could be admitted to the United States, it's always a big issue. Legally admitted to the United States and not have a green card. Who would some of those folks be?
Someone who's sponsored. They have to be sponsored. The high-tech thing is a special thing separate from the usual.
Okay.
Well, students, I guess.
All right, very good. Students. Okay, let's... So, sponsorship. Mm-hmm. There are two classes of sponsorship. Family-based immigration. Family, which represents, I think, somewhere around 60% of all immigration. Papa, mama, or brother, sister, someone's here and says, I want to bring in somebody else in my family. Somehow they got here legally, and they can apply if they are either a legal permanent resident or have attained citizen status. Huh? They can apply. And they have to fill out an affidavit of relationship. And of support. Now this is somewhat new. I think they've always probably had to have an affidavit of relationship. But you talked, someone said about money, Carmen. Money. Here's where things start getting interesting and dicey. 1996, some tremendous things were going on in the United States in Congress. 1996, anyone remember with it, the debate brought about by the 1994 makeup of the Congress with Newt Gingrich?
NG.
What was this? The contract with America, right? 1994, took them a couple years, bam! 1996, bam! What happened? And what were these folks saying? Well, we need welfare reform. You know, no more freeloaders. Huh? They picked up a lot of this sentiment from the fair people and the like, welfare, so there's welfare reform. There's immigration reform. You know, part of the freeloaders are the immigrants. They become a public charge. Public charge, you know, that is, they're coming because of the benefits. That's why people are coming. They're coming because of the benefits. So, and then 1994, I don't know, early 90s, couple of big explosions. One, New York City, World Trade Center. One in Oklahoma City, I think it was 94, wasn't it? 95, Oklahoma City, and there's a new consciousness about whom in the world? Terrorists. Terrorists didn't have anything, you know. So, an anti-terrorism bill, an effective death penalty act. Anti-terrorism and effective death penalty. Well, we're going to get them. If there's terrorism, death penalty. Boom. These weave together in a very interesting way. This also came about at a time of what's called a balanced budget amendment. You know, too much spending, again propelled by the 1994 contract with America, get spending down, and budget deficits. You know, we got to take care of our deficit. It's working, folks. I mean, this stuff is working. Who paid the price? Who paid the price? Well, welfare reform. They said we ought to shave down the welfare. over the next, I think it was 3 to 5 years, I don't remember all of the statistics here, but there were billions of dollars shaved out of welfare stuff. Half of that were benefits that would normally have gone and had gone for 200 years of this nation's history to legal immigrants. We first made a distinction in terms of welcoming these strangers in our hospitality in 1996. There was no distinction in terms of if you were admitted as a legal immigrant or if you were a citizen. These people are admitted in, but we're not going to pay your costs. You know, good luck. Who's going to pay that cost? Affidavit of relationship, affidavit of support. At a minimum, $20,000 a head per year. You can, that you have, if I file an affidavit of support, I have to say, I've got $20,000 I'm willing to set aside for this person so that that person does not become a public charge to the United States and that person will not access any public benefit. That was 1996. That included SSI. It included some Social Security benefits. It included Medicare, Medicaid initially. Included all, it became a big debate. What does it mean not to be a public charge? What if you become ill? What if this person who has supported you dies? What happens? And that's a 10-year commitment. And you are liable. You are liable to pay that cost. If this person accesses it, you can be penalized and pay that back. So say you go to the hospital, and it's a $2,000, $3,000, $10,000, $50,000 hospital bill, you are liable for that person. You cannot. Now, there have been some change. Congress, in all of its wisdom, said, whoops, we went too far, it's not fair. And that was for all immigrants. That included, if you've been here for 20 years, you lost all your benefits at that point. Now they've gone back and said, well, okay, if you were sort of grandfather you in. So if you were here as of 1996, fine, we'll keep paying. But the new ones, no. Or now we've restored some benefits like SSI and Medicaid, and also we've made, it gets real complicated, but the around this, what is a public charge? And they've said that to access things like certain food stamps and WIC program, those are not considered public charge. So that's, thank goodness for that, you know. But this is some radical stuff, huh?
Wasn't this really a global thing going on, too? Because at that same period, Australia did the same thing. Canada did the same thing.
Europe.
European countries were doing the same thing. It was really a global mass.
Yep. You're right. Yeah, it's not, the United States is not alone in this. And there's, And we learned actually from the Europeans primarily, I think, around this issue. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Is there an exclusion on that for countries with whom we have a Social Security agreement or welfare agreements in our treaties?
Boy, I'm not aware of those, and I don't think there are exclusions to it.
Canada is a country that we do have a treaty with. Canadian benefits. Canadians continue to accrue benefits if they have an H-1B visa and continue to work in the U.S.?
H-1B visa, okay. Uh-huh. I don't know.
If they go back to Canada, they get the equivalent of what they've accrued here in the U.S. and Canada.
Yeah.
Vice versa, actually.
Right. Right. I mean, you're going to find loopholes, you're going to find exceptions to about everything. And some of my lawyer friends in immigration work said, never give up. There's always something we can do, and, you know, we'll try.
I know some of the people I work with have obtained Canadian citizenship because it's easier to come here as a Canadian and work.
Yeah,
to come here as citizen of another country that we don't have that agreement.
Right, right. Okay, but let me go on to that, because then there's a second category, and I'll just erase this for the moment, but it's employment-based, based immigration, huh?
Right.
Now here it gets a little fuzzy for me, so I apologize, but that's also somewhere up in the range of about 30% of all of those who immigrate come because an employer has gone, sought them out, and contracted somebody. Again, they have to fill out labor certification stuff and an affidavit of employment, and supposedly there's all sorts of checks and balances. Some members of Congress are more adamant than others on that. That we need to do a search. That there's no American citizen, you know, can do that job before he can employ that person and the like. Well, what that basically means is that they publish a little advertisement in some obscure, arcane, you know, registry someplace, and that, you know, that this job is open. And meanwhile, they're out there with their headhunters just looking for people, and they're coming in. Then there's a third one that is very interesting. It's called the diversity lottery. Anybody in the world can apply. I'd like to go to the United States. And you put your name in, and millions of people go to their local U.S. embassy in their country, consulate, and say, you know, hey, I'd like to go. And so you put your name in, and, you know, then there's a lottery. And I think that's like 10,000 or so per year, something like that. Those are people that don't have any family necessarily, or didn't qualify here. Now, they may have to have some level of support. They may have to have a checking account back there that says, I will not be a public charge. I don't know about that. Probably so. But they can come. And that was built in, I think, about the time of Kennedy, because it used to be that there was a quota system for immigration. And the quota system was basically pegged to, some estimate based on census tracts and things like that in the late 1800s, early 1900s, about how many people of different backgrounds were already here. So, in fact, today, the immigrant stock to the United States still runs around 20 to 25% Germanic. So the quota for immigrants would be 25% from Germany or from German background. But of course, what does that mean? Well, a lot of people hadn't come from some countries of the world, and so their numbers would be lower. And so this begins to break that down, I think about 1960. So we no longer have that. So somebody, say, from who knows where, say Togo, who had very few numbers, might go for that diversity lottery or something like that. And what they did is cap. No one country can send more than 20,000 people. So, you know, people are sending in these affidavits, you know, but no more than 20,000 are going to come from any given country. Now, that sounds like a lot, but again, one interesting thing in Sarco and Carmen, who do you suppose that is meant to?
Mexico.
Sure. It's an upper limit. It sounds good for some, but it's a break for Mexicans, you know, which have high numbers. And okay. So those are basically like three categories of how people can come here.
When did the 20,000 come about?
Yeah, I don't know if that was part of this, the Immigration and Nationality Act of like 1960 or 64, whatever that is, or...
This is that big Chinese threat, too. They didn't want the Chinese coming in.
Yeah. Yeah, the Chinese Alien Act.
Yeah. Right.
Right, Exclusion Act, I think it was called. Chinese Exclusion Act. At one point in history where Chinese were not allowed to come.
Right.
Yeah, yes.
Is that 20,000 for all sorts of, it's a cap for all countries? For
yes.
Any kind of legal immigration?
I believe so. I believe so.
Yeah,
now,
the reason I bring it
right.
up is in the San Francisco area, Chinese is a pretty common language, let's say.
Yes.
A lot of people are native.
Right.
Natives of China. I would have thought 20,000 wouldn't account for that.
Right.
I could be wrong.
Okay.
Well, and one of the interesting things that happens, of course, is that 20,000 isn't necessarily spread out evenly across the country.
Clearly.
And so, you know, 20,000 or half of that, and California has gotten the biggest impact of all of this immigration. That's beginning to change, too, now. People are beginning to spread out to different areas. But California, New York, New Jersey, Florida, Texas, those have been the big immigrant states. But that, I do believe that is. But it brings back an interesting question, which I am not totally clear about. Employment-based immigration. You mentioned the H-1B. They have these different categories like A visas, B visas, C, R, H. All of that is just, it's a list. And it's sort of like where in this, not chronological, but alphabetical listing, you show up. And business shows up down here. So you got H-1B and you got different kinds of business visas and religious. You know, religious worker visas, for example, if we want somebody to work in one of our Ethiopian or Eritrean communities and somebody who speaks that language, we can apply for a religious visa. Some of those are non-immigrant visas. Non-immigrant. The conditions of the visa are you can come and work, you get a green card, but you are not allowed under that visa to permanently immigrate. All right? And the fact is that probably over time, some of those people change their status once they're here and become eligible for legal permanent residency. But I'm not, so that's, that dynamic goes on there. How's our time here? We have about 15 minutes, huh? Now, some of these things play together. That is some of what I've been talking about over the last couple days on refugees and undocumented. Because particularly in this area, but also, say, in Africa right now, you get a tremendous I work a lot with Liberians, both in Minneapolis and around Washington, D.C., and so it's a case study. In 1990, more or less, big war that has continued to the present, 2000. And so there were a number of Liberians in the United States. The numbers were not so great, probably somewhere at that time, 6,000 to 8,000. And, but let's, you know, you think about Mexicans too here. So they were granted, because of the war, they were in the United States, they were granted what's called temporary protected status. They were not obligated to go back to Liberia during the period of the war. This happens constantly. Hurricane Mitch. You know, there were Hondurans in the United States. If you came here, you could stay under temporary protected status. So what happens? Well, 10 years later, here we are, 1998, and the United States is saying, well, it's time to go back. Things are hunky-dory in Liberia. Well, these people have built up homes, they've built up families, they've built up all businesses. Their ties are here. Their kids were born here. Their kids don't know a thing about Liberia other than, you know, what their parents are kind of talking about. And And Liberia is torn up, folks. It's just, there's nothing left. You know, even our Lutheran Phoebe Hospital, we're still trying to patch it up after, you know, there's not much left. So the Liberians are saying, no way, no way. This Charles Taylor, who was the president of Liberia, no way we're going back, you know, because we feel at risk. And so we're, so that's one case study. These people, meanwhile, they have relatives in that fled the war. They weren't they were not in the United States. Their relatives fled the war. They went to the Ivory Coast, Cote d'Ivoire, or they went to, in some cases, Guinea or Sierra Leone, which is kind of interesting, because later they had to flee from Sierra Leone, or they went to Ghana. And they were in huge refugee camps. Now these people, some of them were permanent residents, and so they started applying for these people. So now these numbers are up in the 10 to 15,000 range, and allowed to come in, some as refugees. And so now in Africa, there is a backlog of 400,000 people waiting to enter the United States in all of Africa. 400,000. And the United States, again, judges at different times that, okay, we're going to process these or we're not going to process these. You know, we're going to allow more Liberians to come in or not. Right now, they've said no, no more Liberians. So we're not processing these visas. And they're not saying forever, but like, you know, we just can't handle it, or we think conditions are good. They're actually trying to encourage these people to go back to Liberia, so it'd be a contradiction as we're trying to repatriate and we're paying the United Nations to repatriate these people to admit them to the United States. Last year, we did an interesting thing. The Attorney General, who was in charge of immigration, decided that TPS would not be extended, usually for a year or 18 months. I worked with the Liberians, and there's another way to get an exemption is to go to the President of the United States. He can overrule the Attorney General by declaring what is called deferred enforced departure. So even though, and basically that's a charades. Basically, it's the same thing as TPS, but it sort of says, well, conditions are getting better, but I, as the president, determine that for interests of national security, which has nothing to do with conditions in Liberia, but for conditions of national security for us, in our best interest, these people don't have to go back. So we accomplished that last year. That'll expire in September. Man, that was something. That was awesome.
I have a question. When you say that we decided, the IRS decided, is that a panel of judges? Is that
it's
a decision or a...
That one's done primarily by the State Department in conjunction with the INS and the White House, primarily under what's called the National Security Council. All those folks get together in a room, and they're, you know, like the Liberia desk officer for Liberia from State Department, and, you know, they'll look at the country reports and the on-the-ground assessments. But that one, the U.S. so badly wants a success in Africa, we failed miserably, that we kind of want to say, well, things look pretty good in Liberia. Let's let those people go back. It's like if you think that's the reality you want, you make it happen, despite the fact that the reality is different. It's complex. So we had to fight all those issues, huh? Well, 1996 was this major watershed year, and we're trying to make some reforms of that. We just aren't going to have a lot of time. A couple of big items on the debate right now for who to come into the United States. and under what conditions. Right now, oh, by the way, the overall immigration numbers fluctuate somewhat depending on how quickly people can get processed and all of that. First year I worked in this, 1997, the figure was about 950,000 legal immigrants in that year. I think last year, or the numbers that we saw early last year for 88, it was down somewhat. Something like that, and I don't know, it'll be interesting on the census to figure it. So, and actually that's, pardon me.
New people, you said 130,000, you know, that's not new per year coming in.
Those were refugees, those were refugees. These are legal, these are people that are processed in, they have not been refugees necessarily, okay? Okay, so those are, you know, people. In all over the world.
Those are refugees all over the world.
These are not refugees. These are immigrants now. These are, like if you wanted to go to Canada, you know, there's a process, and you're not a refugee, but, you know, there's probably a process where you can immigrate.
These are not people under persecution.
Correct. That would be the...
These are people who voluntarily went to...
Correct. Okay, so... I'm going to contrast a couple things like H1B and the H2A. Particularly California, Seattle people, do you know what's H1B? What's going on there?
Microsoft.
Silicon Valley, right. These are the high-tech workers. I started in this work in 97, I think it was 98. These are non-immigrant visas now, H-1B, there's a big search, computer industry primarily, high-tech industry. They want workers. They say the United States doesn't supply enough. In 1998, the United States was admitting 65,000 workers under this category. And this is where I'm fuzzy. I don't think those are here. I don't think those are in that because these are non-immigrant visas, which, like I say, may convert at some point along the line. In the 1998 or 99 debate on this, Silicon Valley was saying, we need more. And this is where it got dicey, because these people were saying, no, we don't want more, we want less. You know, they were saying, we don't want any of these 65,000. Well, the Silicon Valley people prevailed, and this went up to about 100,000. So it was virtually a 50% increase, somewhere in there, you know, from 65,000 up to 100,000 for the next 3 years, which would have carried us out to about 2002, I think, or 2001. Bam, the economy's going great guns, folks. You know, so the following year, 1999, and right now, 2000, who's back at the plate in Congress? Silicon Valley, you know, Microsoft, you know. What do they want?
More.
We want more. And what are they asking for? 200,000 workers, high-tech workers, 200,000. That's what they want. And basically they're saying that, you know, we can't find these folks here, American workers. Okay, so some other people like Senator Kennedy and some others are saying, okay, well, we'll give them this, they said this, but what we have to do is do more education and vocational training, and we've got to retread a lot of our workers. Because they're saying that this is a nice way to get rid of these high-paid, middle-range computer types, you know, and replace them with cheaper labor, okay? Yeah. So that dynamic is going on. Yeah. Now there's another, and I would say In terms of this, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, you know, there's a clamor right now, and these people aren't among those, tired, the poor, the... These are well-trained, well-educated people.
Huh? From what countries are they?
Well, India, quite largely.
I can answer that. I've been trying to hire people into a... I'm a manager for a software company. I've been trying to hire people, and I can't find people in this country. So I've been interviewing people from Mexico, Israel, Canada, Russia, Belarus, Ukraine, China, Hong Kong, all the Southeast Asian countries, Australia, New Zealand, wherever I can find them.
Right. So, yeah. Interesting.
Except yeah, not
it's,
Africa.
It's real. It's real. I mean, and it's to keep this economy going. And Alan Greenspan testified before Congress in February. And his thing was, you know, we got to keep the immigration going, because if we don't, we are vulnerable to a serious economic crash. And mostly what he was talking about is up here, but ironically also down here. What are these? Agriculture. Who are the people that provide us our cheap food? Migrant workers, or immigrant workers, largely. And there are some programs out there, and this is one place where I want the church to work. I'm going to do some work now in Washington State and Oregon around some of the migrant farm communities out here next couple weeks. But we've got to get a handle and come to some determination how we're going to work with this, I think. I'm going to let this thing go. That's going to play itself out. I'm not going to weigh in much there. But where I want to weigh in is down here. Out of approximately, I just came from a Senate hearing a couple weeks ago on this ag, they want a new guest worker program. Reminiscent in some way of the old Bracero program that was in place from the 20s up into, I think, 1954. It was abolished, or maybe later, 64. It was abolished. So I get some of this from that Senate subcommittee hearing on immigration where they were proposing Senator Gordon Smith from Oregon and Senator Bob Graham from Florida, ag states. They're saying that out of 1.5 million field workers that are in the United States currently, about 700,000, perhaps even higher, are undocumented. 700,000, you imagine that, out there in the fields today, Wenatchee, Willamette Valley, Columbia Valley, they're out there. This would, in some way, allow some of these people to adjust and give them temporary legal residence. Not legal permanent residence, but temporary legal residence. But under what terms? I mean, what are they going to get other than this temporary status? Well, if they work out in the next 7 years for at least 5 years, at least five out of the next 7 years and 180 days in agriculture for the same employer, then you might be able to adjust your status to become a legal permanent resident. Okay? So, basically, United Farm Workers, the U.S. Catholic Conference, has opposed this new initiative because it doesn't provide guarantees for sufficient wages, for housing, and the like. But there are people, there's a Lutheran pastor who works with migrants down in the Willamette Valley who I hope to visit. He came to that Senate subcommittee hearing invited by Senator Smith to speak on behalf of the farm workers. And it was a little smooth. He didn't say, "I support your bill." He just said, "We want something. Thank you for acknowledging us out here." Because a lot of these people are saying this is like an indentured servant program. And some even say it's a slavery, enslavement kind of thing. But others are saying, give us some crumbs from the table. some crumbs. Even if there's an option, even if it's 7 years out there, my goodness, it's better than being, as they say, we are fugitives in this land. We are undocumented. And tomorrow we could be back in Mexico or back, you know, if we're picked up, because we don't have a green card. Yes?
You know what it seems like to me, too, is that while all other peoples that immigrate to this country, they come here with the idea of assimilating into the United States. They're more or less in agreement with that. Even the Chinese and the Japanese, they come so far away from a distant land, they come here and they feel like they're foreigners and they do want to assimilate. But Mexicans, on the other hand, don't feel that way. They don't want to assimilate. They feel no need to assimilate. As you mentioned before, half of the Mexican territory was militarily confiscated. They know that. Mexicans know that. Americans don't know that. Even if they know it, they deny it. Therefore, the big fear in letting Mexicans in, not only is it there's some racism there because, of course, they're dark skin and primarily, for the most part, indigenous people, if not pure-blooded Indians, they're mestizos, they're mixed bloods. But Mexico, because of our proximity to Mexico, Mexicans are not going to let go of their culture. We can see that right now everywhere they're at. They're speaking their language, they're listening to their music, they're practicing their customs and their traditions, and they're not going to let go of that. They're not willing to become Americans because they know that they are Americanos.
Yeah. You're raising some really interesting questions on, and again, it's fascinating. And there are people that spend their whole life on this kind of ethnology and demography and kind of what goes on with immigrant communities, and use one term that's often used, assimilation. You know, others, you hear about the melting pot. Is that in fact true? Talk about the Chinese, and you make the statement that they assimilate more than, say, the Mexicans want to. I'm not so sure if you were in San Francisco or New York, if that's in fact the case for the Chinese, you know?
Yeah. Now that the numbers have increased, now there's...
Numbers is a big part of it.
We're safe. We're side by side maintaining our identity, our culture, our heritage.
You know, do we have assimilation? Where is it? Melting pot? Are we some kind of salad where, you know, each little piece maintains its integrity, a carrot, an onion, you know, and it's all in one big pot?
You know, there is a point about what you're mentioning. I live in Mount Vernon, which, of course, is in the Skagit Valley, and there's a huge population of Hispanic, Mexicans, Hondurans, Puerto Ricans, everything's there. I live down the street from a fellow who is an immigrant. He's attained U.S. citizenship, and as the years have gone by, he's become more and more American. And I don't think it's because he doesn't want to lose his heritage. It's because he's doing business with people, he's learning the language and the customs and the culture. And people are buying farms in the community. White farmers don't want to farm anymore because it's too much work and too little money. So immigrants are buying the farms and they're bringing their relatives in to work. And it's the change over time is interesting as they're attaining property and status in the community.
You know, and if you look at that in some wider circles too, I mean, we're going through some interesting changes. I mean, the land, say that I was out on a farm in Omaha, west of Lincoln, Nebraska, in a Swedish farm. I mean, the grandfather had settled that land. Well, that was somebody else's land at one point, you know, and now it's like three or four generations later, they don't know if they're going to be able to hang on to that land. But as you say, somebody else is coming. And you know, those might be even Hmong, some of the Hmong people, and some of the Mexicans that have been mostly in the urban areas are now going out to rural areas, and because, again, of quality of life, they're tired of the gang banging and the drugs and some of that. And now if they've got legal status, they'll start spreading out. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting, you know, and it raises again these fundamental questions about sovereignty and an inherent right to this land. And, you know, we've somehow got to get over and this, that because it's this way, or we have the right, and I'm not so sure that I've even assimilated very well. I mean, I still think out of a very Scandinavian, that's my background and my family, and that's, you know, that, you know, I can't go into the Chinese culture very easily. I can a little bit in the Latin America culture, but not, you know, I'm not fully assimilated here with. So our time, unfortunately, is up. This has been delightful, and we scratched the surface. Tomorrow we're going to look at a little bit our own immigrant history stories and ask some questions about that. And then who are the more recent immigrants in your communities, and how are they being welcomed? And what kind of hospitality is out there for these strangers. Thanks very much.